If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
This is a History Extra production. In 1942, the forces of Nazi Germany and its allies came head-to-head with those of the Soviet Union at a city on the Volga River. The Battle of Stalingrad was to become one of the grimmest on the Eastern Front, as infantry troops slogged it out in bombed-out cellars and freezing conditions. In the second episode of our series on World War II's greatest battles, I spoke to the military historian James Holland to find out more about Stalingrad. James is the author of several books on the Second World War and also the co-founder of the Chalk History Festival, which runs from the 24th to the 30th of June this year. We're offering an exclusive 15% off Chalk Festival day tickets when you become a subscriber to either History Extra or BBC History Magazine. Check out these offers and other benefits at historyextra.com/pod. Thanks for joining us again, James. Let's start with a basic question. Why did you nominate the Battle of Stalingrad as being one of the greatest battles of World War II?
Well, it's just such a big turning point, not just in the war on the Eastern Front, but in the Second World War as a whole, certainly the Second World War against Nazi Germany. I mean, Barbarossa, the invasion of the Soviet Union, has already fallen short. So the Germans are already in trouble in the Soviet Union, although, you know, on paper, it looks like it's very much sort of one-way traffic still. And although the Red Army has had a few little successes, notably in the kind of counterattack opposite Moscow back in December 1941, really the Germans are still very much the sort of dominating in this kind of campaign on the Eastern Front. Stalingrad is the absolute reversal of that. It's the point where the Germans are just not going to achieve their aims in the Soviet Union anymore. The runes have already been written, but this is the absolute confirmation. And it's a real shock, and it marks a major turning point. Because the whole reason for going to Soviet Union in the first place is because they need the resources that the Soviet Union has to offer. And if you can't get your hands on them, and you're also burning up vast amounts of resources, both in terms of manpower and material, in the process of not achieving very much, then it makes you realize that your whole campaign, your whole strategy for the war is suddenly lying in tatters. And that's the consequence of the catastrophic surrender of the German 6th Army and indeed the Romanian, Hungarian and Italian 8th Army as a consequence of that.
We'll get into some of the reasons for that dramatic collapse of the German army in a minute. I think you've laid out some good context there. So as you say, we've got the German invasion of the Soviet Union, Barbarossa. It's not going that well. But why Stalingrad specifically? Why did Hitler want to capture Stalingrad? Why was it such an important point?
Yeah, so originally, Stalingrad is not the big thing that it becomes. Stalingrad is actually part of the targets for Case Blue, Operation Blue, which is the German summer offensive of 1942. So basically what happens is Barbarossa runs out of steam because it's winter and it's getting dark and the snow's come down and they've just kind of overstretched themselves. So everyone needs to take a pause. In fact, actually, the Red Army then counterattacks in March. That fails. They then try again in May. Again, that fails. Consequence of that is another kind of 240,000 Soviet prisoners in German hands. But at the same time, there's also the siege of Leningrad going on. And at the same time, they've got to reduce Sevastopol and the Crimea. So that's also happening. Once that's all out of the way, the main offensive for the German offensive in the summer, once the days have lengthened and the weather has turned in their favour and you can sort of, you know, move your panzers and your armour and all the rest of it much more freely because it's summer and not wet and muddy and snowy. The main plan is to reach down into the Caucasus and get to the oil fields. Not to get to Moscow, it's to get to the oil fields. And that's because they need oil desperately. They don't have hardly any natural oil at all. The only oil they've got is from the Romanian oil fields in Ploiești. And that's a very, very small amount. The rest of it is synthetic fuel and it's incredibly expensive to produce and costly in terms of materials and financially. So that's no good. So they really, really need this fuel, first to kind of deny it to the Soviet Union, but also to have it for themselves. So that is the plan for Case Blue. So Case Blue is divided into four parts. The first point is to get Voronezh, then it is to get to the River Don, and then it is to get to the Volga and Stalingrad, and then it is to wheel south down into the Caucasus, which lies between the Black and Caspian Seas. So Stalingrad is just one part of the operation, but as things pan out, it becomes pretty much the main event, because Hitler starts to meddle and starts to interfere and starts to muck around with the original plan and change the plan for Case Blue mid-flow.
And I guess it seems like a really significant line in the sand, doesn't it? Partly because the city bears the name of Joseph Stalin. Do you think that that was significant in any way?
Well, it is, but it only becomes, it sort of becomes increasingly so once it becomes clear to Hitler and to the Germans that Stalin's not going to throw in the towel anytime soon. You know, that he states at the end of August, on the 25th of August, he states that it's going to be a state of a siege. Stalingrad must never surrender. They must fight to the last man, all that kind of stuff. And so this is like a sort of red rag to a bull. I mean, you know, Hitler just can't resist it. It's a kind of, sort of trial of strength, and it's a trial of two dictators, as well as their own forces. But what happens is, because originally Case Blue is going to be divided into these four parts, so they get Voronezh at the beginning of July. But this is the first time the Red Army has made a strategic retreat. So what's happened in the past is Stalin said, you know, there can't be any retreats. And this is how Kyiv, for example, falls in September 1941. Falls because Stalin refuses to allow his commanders to retreat from Kiev when they have the opportunity. The consequence of that is kind of 750,000 people being surrounded and put into the bag, you know, becoming prisoners. This shows that Stalin is kind of learning from those mistakes, that he's learning to trust a bit more his commanders, that he's giving them a little bit more freedom to make their own military judgments, you know, on the spot. Not a huge amount, but more. So the retreat from Voronezh is a key moment because they have chosen to fall back, and they fall back to the River Don, about 60 miles, rather than contest it and become encircled as a result of another 250,000 people in the bag. So that is a really big moment. But what happens is, as the Germans follow up from further east from Voronezh, they actually come up against quite strong Red Army rear guards, which keep them occupied for quite a long time, which now allows the Stalingrad front and the Ukrainian front to fall back behind the River Don. And this is all starting to take a bit longer than Hitler wants. So what he decides to do is actually split his forces. So he creates Army Group A and Army Group B. And Army Group B is going to be Sixth Army and the Romanians, two Romanian armies, the Hungarian Army and the Italian Eighth Army under von Bock. And Army Group A is going to be the bulk of the panzer forces and all German units, which are going to wheel south ahead of further operations against the Don and the Volga and Stalingrad down into the Caucasus. The problem with that is you're now doing two operations concurrently. You're moving south into the Caucasus and at the same time trying to get across the Don and the River Volga and capture Stalingrad. And the point is what you're doing is then splitting your forces into two, which means you've only got half the strength. And to get to Baku and to Mykop, you know, these are phenomenal distances which require huge amounts of supply lines. And the whole point was to clear that whole part of the front first so that you can secure your own supply lines again. Then you can put the whole bulk of your forces into driving down into the Caucasus. But Hitler changes his mind. Von Bock complains about this and so gets fired. And meanwhile, the Red Army are pulling back behind the Volga.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Amazon Prime. You know Amazon Prime is not just a shipping subscription, right? It's got everything, including streaming TV and movies on Prime Video. And of course, Prime's fast, free shipping. Go from watching your favorite shows to getting your favorite things. Whatever you're into, it's on Prime. Visit Amazon.com/Prime to get more out of whatever you're into.
So if we're looking at Stalingrad, the city in particular, when Hitler had set his sights on it, how did he launch his assault? Where did he begin?
So 62nd Army, which is the army that's in protecting Stalingrad, falls back to Stalingrad on the 10th of September. And what one has to understand about Stalingrad is it's on the western banks of the Volga. And the Volga is incredibly wide at this point. There's almost nothing on the far side, on the eastern side. There's no part of this. So Stalingrad, the city, is strung. It's only about like a mile and a half, 2 miles wide, but it's about 30 miles long if you include all the kind of industrial bits at the north and kind of other suburbs to the south and all the rest of it. I mean, the heart of it is a kind of sort of 10, 12 mile stretch. It's a pretty big city. It's like 750,000 people there. Oh, 300,000 have already been evacuated before this. They know it's going to become this great big battle the moment that Stalin says it's going to be a state of siege on the 25th of August. So they fall back into the kind of heart of Stalingrad on the 10th of September. And German troops reach the banks of the Volga to the south on the kind of same sort of day. But the real battle for Stalingrad starts with an early morning mass attack by the Luftwaffe, and particularly with Stuka dive bombers, who absolutely pummel the city. But there can be no surrender now. I mean, you know, this is a fight to the death as far as the 62nd Army is concerned. And actually, Lopatin, who has been the commander of the 62nd Army and who has kind of overseen the kind of falling back to Stalingrad, is then sacked. And General Vasily Chukov is put in his place. And he arrives on the night of the 11th, 12th of September to take over. And he's tough as old nuts. You know, he's an old kind of sort of Russian peasant stock. He's only 42 years old. Absolutely ruthless, very quick to laugh, loves his booze and his vodka and all the rest of it, but absolutely tough as nails and absolutely is the right person for this particular task.
So fighting on the ground lasts for 5 months and it was very, very hard going. Can you give us a sense of how that fighting unfolded and what it was like for the men who were there, the boots on the ground?
Yeah, it's absolutely brutal. I mean, as we're discovering from all the reports and all the kind of footage we're seeing of what's going on in Gaza, you know, fighting in built-up areas, fibula, as it's known, is incredibly difficult because this is one of the reasons for flattening buildings, is because then your vision is greater if you haven't got a great big building in front of you. Because the problem is it's very close quarters. You can't really see in front of you because you've got a building. And even if it's been hammered by the Luftwaffe, you've still got, you know, plenty of buildings which are still kind of, they might all be damaged, but they're still standing. Albeit with perhaps a wall knocked down or, you know, a floor destroyed or whatever, but they're still there. And it means it's very difficult. And all the rubble on the ground and all the rest of it, you know, Germans just don't have bulldozers in the way that the Americans and the Allies do, for example. So they can't clear that rubble. It means that you can't bring to bear all your strengths in kind of, you know, armored fighting vehicles such as panzers and half tracks and armored cars and assault guns and all the rest of it. You can, but not with the freedom that you would like. And so it becomes a kind of infantry slogging match. And what the Germans would find, they'd take, you know, 3 days to try and take a particular building. They'd then get it and then discover that Soviet Red Army soldiers are there on the ground floor again the following day because there's huge tunnel networks. It's much, much easier to defend than it is to attack. And it's easier to defend in an urban environment than almost any other. So it becomes this absolutely brutal Rattenkrieg, as it becomes known, the kind of rat war. And that's because they're kind of, you know, they're existing in cellars and they're, you know, moving from wall to wall. And, you know, you could be find yourself in a situation where you're in a multi-story building where, you know, well, the top floor has got Red Army troops, the next one's got Germans, and then it's got Soviet again, you know, and everyone's all jumbled up and it's incredibly close quarters. And one of the things about warfare is it's kind of sort of easier when you can't really see your enemy and you're just sort of firing artillery pieces and long range stuff or their little dots in the distance. But when it's absolutely, you know, hand to hand, face to face, that's a different kettle of fish altogether. The kind of psychological damage and strain of that kind of fighting is much harder.
So you mentioned this idea of Rattenkrieg and fighting in tunnels. I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about that experience and what it would have been like for the men involved.
Yeah, because, well, the experience would have been absolutely horrendous. I mean, you're basically living your life mostly underground, you know, in cellars. Whether you're Soviet, you know, Soviet Union, they also had under the cliffs of the Volga, which weren't massively high, but they're significant. There were also lots of dugouts and stuff. I mean, that's where Chukov had his dugout, for example. So you're spending an awful lot of time living underground because that's the safest bit. It's dank, it's horrible, it's lots of rats. You're not getting enough food. And when you do appear above the surface, you know, it's incredibly dangerous. You know, you're exposed to snipers, you're exposed to mortar and shell fire, and you're exposed to hand-to-hand combat in buildings which go over multiple floors. So it's just an incredibly tough, brutal environment and lots of dead left lying around. I mean, you know, because you can't retrieve your wounded because to do so exposes yourself. So it's the stench is appalling, sewers, rotting bodies. I mean, just unspeakably awful is the truth of the matter.
You said earlier in our conversation that this was a city of 750,000 people. Obviously, as you mentioned, some of those were evacuated. But for those people who weren't evacuated, what became of them? What happened to the civilians?
They were basically given weapons and told to kind of to help. I mean, they were digging tunnels. They were absolutely put to use and used as messengers and used as carriers and transport and dispatch riders and all this kind of stuff. So they all played a role. I mean, once you were there, you were there. And there was absolutely nothing you could do about it. You weren't allowed back across the Volga and you couldn't go forward because there were any Germans. So you were stuck there. I mean, it was incredibly brutal because when the battle begins in September 1942, it's absolutely brutally, brutally hot, mosquitoes and all the rest of it, and just very, very difficult conditions. But those conditions don't really improve because suddenly winter comes and, you know, it starts to rain, it gets very cold. Then it gets even colder. You know, by December, it's kind of snow on the ground. The first snow, I think, falls on the 16th of November, something like that. You know, so the snow falls and the temperatures plummet. So in summer, it's incredibly hot. In winter, it's abysmally cold. Neither of which are ideal conditions in which to be fighting. And you know, the Germans just don't have enough kit to do what they need to do. Now, they are, you know, and you're having these sort of incredibly desperate battles where, you know, for example, there's a tractor factory at the top of the north of Stalingrad, sort of right on the suburbs in the sort of industrial north. You know, and that changes hands repeatedly, you know, up as 14 times, separate times. It changes hands on the 14th of October. On the 17th of October, it changes hands 13 times. So you're having, you know, and all the time, even when the Germans are winning and they eventually take the tractor factory, for example, they're still being attrited themselves. They're still losing huge amounts of men. So every single unit is getting more and more and more depleted. You have the kind of stress and strain of combat, and then you have the stress and strain of being in these conditions, and then you have the stress and strain of suddenly the tide turning, which is what happens in November 1942.
It strikes me that conditions are always an issue that come up when we're talking about fighting in Russia. I mean, it's an issue that Napoleon had, you know, more than 100 years earlier. Were the Germans just ill-prepared for what they were going to face on the Eastern Front, or were they making strategic mistakes as well?
Yeah, they're making massive strategic mistakes. I mean, one of the big problems is, and this goes back to the failure to take Moscow in December 1941, is that Hitler then makes himself commander-in-chief of the army, as well as being commander-in-chief of the armed forces. And he just starts meddling. And one of the reasons the Germans are so successful at the start of the war is because they've got lots of highly experienced people, people who've fought long and hard about how to fight a war, and they're given a huge amount of latitude to get on with it. And as a commander at the front, you're trusted to make your own calls, and you know, you'll be judged by your successes or your failures, and if you fail, you'll get sacked, and that's all there is to it. But what it means is that people have the ability, commanders at the start of the war have the ability, or German commanders have the ability to kind of make snap decisions and act on their instincts and the rest of it. Those days have long gone. You know, from December 1941 onwards, from the moment that Hitler takes direct control, he is really controlling. You know, he's incredibly interfering, micromanaging, and whatever he pronounces has to be enacted immediately. His force for Case Blue is already not as big as it was for Barbarossa, and Barbarossa didn't achieve its aims. The distances they're intending to travel for Case Blue are even greater, and they've got fewer forces. So, you know, quite a lot of panzer forces, even by the start of Case Blue, are only operating at 60% or 70% or 50% or whatever. You know, so they're already under strength. So to then split your force in two, which is what he does, is insane. And also to allow himself to get stuck at Stalingrad, get sucked into a kind of urban battle, which is incredibly attritional, incredibly debilitating, and which is dragging your troops away from the main effort, which is to get to the oil fields of the Caucasus, is also a terrible, terrible mistake.
So if we have strategic mistakes on the German side, can we say that we have great strategic decisions of any kind on the Soviet side?
Yeah, absolutely, because they're learning on the hoof. You know, this is the slightly worrying thing about what's going on in Ukraine at the moment. You see the Russians also learning on the hoof there. You know, the original plan in February 1922 went completely pear-shaped. They were underprepared. They weren't ready for it. Now, though, they're starting to kind of work out how to do this, and it's all looking quite worrying. And it's kind of a similar situation on the Eastern Front in the Second World War. And what you find is Stalin has started to get more of the right people in the right positions. So, you know, the right commanders are now commanding these fronts. People like Rokossovsky are coming to the fore. You know, supremely competent and talented senior commander. You know, Zhukov's absolutely brilliant. And they come up with these various plans to do major counterattacks. One that's going to be a major one, which is quite a long way to the north, but also Operation Uranus, which is the idea of this is a pincer movement, a bit like the Germans have been meeting out on the Red Army, but the other way around this time. And what they realize is that Sixth Army has been sucked into Stalingrad, and that either side of them are the Romanians and Hungarians and Italians, who are much, much weaker. So what you could do is you could cross the Volga, burst around the back through the Romanians and the Hungarians, either side of Sixth Army, and pinch out the whole of Sixth Army in a massive encirclement, so that you've still got them facing 62nd Army and the Volga at the front, but behind them are these two fronts that have come, you know, the fronts are like an army group, that have come round the back and pinched off. And that happens in the third week of November. And it's catastrophe for the Germans. I mean, there's no other way of saying it.
So that's an interesting point about the fact that the Axis forces also, as you say, contained Italians, Hungarians, Romanians. What was going on there? Were they just less well trained than the Germans? Were they less well coordinated? Why were they weaker?
They were weaker because they're poor countries. They had a less sophisticated army than the Germans. The Germans could have trained them themselves, could have lent them lots of weapons and so on, but they don't. I mean, the Germans always treat all their allies absolutely abominably, and that is absolutely the case with the Italian Eighth Army and the Hungarian Army and the two Romanian armies. I mean, you know, they're just appallingly looked after by their allies, and they're not very good, is the truth of it.
If we're moving towards a point in which, you know, German surrender is becoming inevitable, are there any moments that you would highlight on that timeline that you think we should know about?
Well, the big one is the meeting of the two pincers, the encirclement at Sovietsky, a brilliant named village of Sovietsky, on the 23rd of November. And that's the moment that Sixth Army are surrounded. And from that moment onwards, it's going to be very difficult to get them out. Now, there's one way of getting them out, and that is for them to fight straight out away, you know, immediately, just gather all their forces and go for it. But by this time, it's already snowing. You know, the temperatures are dropping. They're sort of stuck in Stalingrad. It's very difficult. Hitler says to General Paulus, who is the 6th Army commander, says, don't worry, we're going to get you out of there. Just stay where you are and await relief. And then orders von Manstein, who's been involved in the siege of Leningrad up to the north, he's now down and he gets sent off to try and do a thrust from the southwest. But it fails. And of course it's going to fail because they just don't have the strength to be able to kind of overwhelm a huge Soviet front that is finally starting to believe in itself. And so von Manstein's kind of relief doesn't work. Goering, the commander-in-chief of the Luftwaffe, promises plenty of supplies to 6th Army and so that they'll be able to do a fighting attack out as well. The promised 350 tons a day doesn't get anywhere near that. It's more like sort of 70 tons a day, if they're lucky. And it's just not enough. And by December, Paulus's men are all starting to starve and they're in really, really big trouble, running out of ammunition, the whole thing.
Your point about supplies and ammunition is one I wonder if we could just touch on before we turn to the surrender, because how important was equipment in this battle?
Well, equipment's always really important. I mean, the problem is that the Germans can't bring their equipment to bear because of all the rubble and because of fighting and all the rest of it, and then because of the falling temperatures and snow and all the rest of it. You know, the Luftwaffe is ineffective, apart from that opening day on the 13th of September when the Stukas come over. I mean, it's largely impotent, while the Red Army Air Force is sort of increasing in power. This is the time of the Sturmoviks, you know, the Il-2s, these ground attack little fighter planes who are incredibly successful at this time. So equipment is part of it, but the real problem is they're just running short of supplies. They can't resupply themselves after the 23rd of November because they're surrounded. So the road link is now closed. The only way of getting in supplies is to fly it in. But again, conditions are such. The Luftwaffe is much weaker than it ever was. And all those things are kind of working together to work against Paulus and his 6th Army and relieving them.
So when German forces do surrender, they do so against the orders of Adolf Hitler. So how did Hitler respond to news of this surrender? I'm imagining he wasn't very happy about it.
No, he was decidedly unhappy. I mean, he knows it's going to happen. And you know, von Paulus gives all the warnings he possibly can. I mean, he keeps saying, you know, our men are starving. We can't hold on. We're running out of ammunition. You know, you can only do what you can do. You know, 24,000 wounded soldiers were actually flown out, evacuated out of Stalingrad. But, you know, what can you do? So Hitler now realizes this is what's going to happen, that the 6th Army are going to have to surrender. So he then promotes Paulus on the 31st of January to field marshal. Because Paulus knows that no German field marshal or Prussian field marshal has ever surrendered. So basically, you know, he's saying, I'm going to make you field marshal and now commit suicide. You know, commit seppuku, as the Japanese would have called it. But he doesn't. He allows himself to be arrested, captured at 7:35 on the morning of the 31st of January. And then it's kind of all over, really. I mean, it's finally all over on the 2nd of February. But you can say, don't surrender, all you like. But there's a point where troops are overrun because they're too ill, they're starving, they haven't got any ammunition, there's nothing, you know, they can no longer fight. It's not that they're disobeying orders, they no longer physically can do so. So that's the end of it.
This is something that we've touched on throughout our conversation, but just to really nail it down, if you had to nominate a couple of really, really key factors that were to blame for German failure at Stalingrad, what would you put forward?
Well, just Hitler being involved in the first place, having a completely unrealistic plan in the first place, and then splitting his forces. I mean, that's the main thing. And just allowing himself to get sucked into a battle that just didn't need to be fought.
We're talking about Stalingrad as one of the key turning points of the Second World War. Can you give us a sense of its significance in a much wider context, in a global context at the time?
Yeah, it's just such a big marker because this is the first really major catastrophic defeat in the Eastern Front for German forces. And it's come on the back of other kind of changes in fortune. You know, the Panzer Army, Africa being defeated at Alamein, for example, back in October. Not on the same scale, but, you know, a similar scale in terms of troops lost, German troops lost, I suppose. And it's just the point where the whole edifice starts to crumble in a very obvious way. In fact, it already has started crumbling. It starts to crumble really back end of 1941 when Barbarossa fails. But it's overt by fall of Stalingrad. And it gets followed very quickly by a very infamous speech by Joseph Goebbels, propaganda minister at the Sports Palace in Berlin in the beginning of February, following this defeat. And that's where he stands up and says, are you all ready for total war? It is now total war. You know, this is no longer about victory. This is about survival. And if you don't, all every single man, woman and child, if you don't kind of, you know, back the war effort, it's going to be Armageddon. And that's a terrible wake-up call for the Germans, who, let's face it, you know, just a few years earlier, July 1940, had kind of rather assumed they'd already won the entire war. So a real disaster of enormous magnitude. And the other thing is, just around the corner is the start of the strategic air campaign against Germany. You know, the night of the 5th, 6th of March is the first major assault by RAF Bomber Command, the newly revamped Bomber Command under Arthur Harris, you know, on the attack on the Ruhr industrial heartland. And this is the point where suddenly all the years of aggression, of attacking, now it's all about defence and defending yourselves and kind of, you know, the huge empire that had been achieved in those early years, the Blitzkrieg, is starting to contract again.
So obviously a huge disaster for Germany, but even for the victors, the Soviet Union, you have a flattened city, pretty much. You have a huge death toll. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about the extent of the casualties and why the death toll was so high.
Yeah, it's very high when you're not prepared to give an inch. I mean, you know, that close quarter fighting is very difficult to preserve human life, you know, because buildings are collapsing all around you. There's sort of stone and rock and shrapnel flying everywhere. So it's just a very, very brutal environment and very tough. But, you know, Stalin wasn't going to allow something like human casualties and civilian casualties and casualties of his troops to get in the way of this defensive battle. You know, he was going to make sure that it ended up being a huge Soviet victory and that they absolutely didn't give any ground at all in the town. And that came at an absolutely terrible price.
In the years since and the decades since, how has Stalingrad been viewed in Russia or in the Russian imagination?
Oh, in the Russian imagination, it's absolutely one of the great triumphs of the Second World War and, you know, or the Great Patriotic War, as they call it. It's an absolute central piece. You know, it is looked upon very proudly as one of the sort of defining moments of the war and of an absolutely enormous achievement. I mean, Stalingrad to this day obviously is completely rebuilt and massively grown in size and all the rest of it. But Pavlov's house, you know, the remains of that are still there. All these sort of key moments, you know, key places in the battle, and there's monuments and memorials and so on. I mean, you know, you absolutely can't miss it. And it's very much part of that myth and part of that myth that sort of Putin likes to sort of channel into this idea that the sort of great patriotic war, this idea that all Russians are fighting for their own freedoms and all the rest of it, even though obviously it's a communist state.
And finally, James, at the end of each of these episodes, we're doing a little bit of alternate history. So what do you think might have happened if Germany had won at Stalingrad?
Well, actually, I don't think it would have made a huge amount of difference because they would have still burned themselves up. I mean, you know, they would never have achieved what they were wanting to achieve. The supply lines were too great to get to the Caucasus. And also, the other thing is, I mean, even they would have they managed to reach Mykop, but even by the time they got there, the oil wells were already on fire. I mean, the idea that Baku, which was the largest part of the Soviet oil fields, was going to still be intact when they got there is just ludicrous. And even if they did get there and the Soviet Union, you know, and the Red Army soldiers didn't burn all these oil fields, how are they going to transport all this oil? You know, there were no pipelines then. I mean, there were, but they were going backwards to the Urals. There was no pipeline back to Germany. There wasn't the railway capacity to do it. I mean, the idea of we'll get to the Caucasus oil fields and, you know, all our dreams will come true and everything will be fine and dandy and we'll kind of win the war is just absurd. And that just wasn't going to happen. So they would have come unstuck somewhere else is the truth of it, because by that stage, the Soviet Union had just amassed such vast arrays of manpower and indeed better equipment, things like the Katyusha rockets, the Sturmoviks, the bigger tanks, upgraded T-34, all this sort of stuff. Yeah, the Germans didn't really have any answers to any of that. And Case Blue is called off in, you know, October. It's kind of run out of steam. So that's two summer offensives that haven't achieved what they're trying to achieve. And They don't have the manpower that the Soviet Union has. They don't have the resources that the Soviet Union have. I mean, I think it would have all come a cropper.
That was James Holland speaking to me, Ellie Cawthorne. James is a military historian and the author of several books on the Second World War. As I mentioned at the beginning, he's also the co-founder of the Chalk History Festival. This year, it runs from the 24th to the 30th of June. And as a media partner of the festival, we're offering an exclusive 15% off day tickets when you become a subscriber to History Extra or BBC History Magazine. You can find this offer and other benefits at historyextra.com/pod.